everyone, and welcome to episode 112 of Heavy Potter's Heavy Cast. I actually looked it up before this time, so I know what episode we're on.
And it's great, we just started and immediately a car is honking outside of my window, so this is an auspicious beginning.
Well, I don't hear anything, so it should be fine.
So I should have just stayed quiet, I guess.
No. Well, if you stay quiet, then I would hear the car honking and nothing else.
True.
Okay.
How's it going? How are you?
I'm good. It's fast. Life is fast here. I'm still getting adjusted to everything.
Yeah.
Going to underground restaurant launches and all that jazz.
You're finally embracing your hipster roots.
Yeah, I looked into that $20 coffee and I don't think it you can get it anymore. I think it was a event thing.
A limited launch, limited edition, $20 coffee.
Yeah, but so I just saw an article about tacos inside croissants, instead of a taco shell. Yeah, instead of a taco shell, they have a hardened croissant on the outside. I'm going to go try to get that today, if possible.
That actually sounds delicious.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Cool.
Yep.
Music?
All right. Yeah, music. God damn it. Okay. So last week, we promised a deep segment on After the Burial. We're going to dig deep into After the Burial's career.
Someone, please free me from this hell.
Well, you gotta talk to Jay-Z, man. Did you see that Jay-Z's beefing with Trump now?
Yeah, what? The only thing I saw from that is Donald Trump's tweet. I don't have context at all.
The context is Jay-Z was interviewed on some program and he said that the shithole comment is a very bad thing.
Uh-huh.
And Trump somehow picked up on it and is now beefing with Jay-Z.
Oh, man.
I don't know if this is the worst timeline or not even the worst timeline. Nobody imagined this would happen. The chaos.
I don't
timeline.
Think we're on a timeline anymore. It's just a cloud of shit and chaos.
Yeah, it's there's surely a reference from a TV show or a comic book for this, but the timeline is just gone. Fuck, I watched this. If I had the reference, it would have been perfect. This is the DC Universe post-Flashpoint. There you go, nerds.
Oh my god.
See, I established my nerd cred. I know things.
Yeah. You salvaged it. You came back from that.
Okay.
Okay. Cool.
Speaking of bands that came back from bad things. God damn it.
Oh, okay. Man.
So, After the Burial deep segment.
Yes.
So, After the Burial is a band.
I'll start. So I think what's interesting about this deep segment is maybe for the first time we're doing one of these on a band that one of us disproportionately loves the band more than the other. Maybe Devin Townsend is also an example because I'm a much bigger fan than you are. Although when you go back to the early works, that's not true at all. So I'm looking forward to this conversation because I obviously knew who After the Burial were and I had heard their music several times. There was even a time when I used to listen to them actively, but that was a while ago. And this deep segment forced me to get reacquainted with their discography. And I kind of did that because I've said this several times on the podcast. I didn't grow up within the scene and you kind of did. You were on Seven Strings and all that shit. And you kind of, you've been with the blog longer. So I kind of approached them without a lot of the baggage and the stereotypes. So I think it's an interesting conversation, between a veteran and someone who's very, very familiar with them. And it's one of your all time favorite bands, right?
Yeah.
And someone who appreciates them, but has never really dug deep. That discourse can be interesting.
Yep. All right, so After the Burial, they got famous when, in 2008, at the height of, the Sumerian Core thing, their album Rare Form released on Sumerian Records.
And
it was amazing. But before that, they had a slightly less known debut album on this label called Corrosive Recordings, which I have no idea what that is.
And it wasn't even a label, a record deal. It was just distribution. Mm-hmm. So it was very off the grid.
Yeah. apparently they have, like, they distributed, like, God Forbid, like, the first album of Veil of Maya. I guess that's how they made the connection.
Yeah, like, maybe.
Cool. So, Forging a Future Self is their debut album. On this album, they had... So, After the Burial have had three vocalists. The debut album had Nick Wellner. Rareform originally had Grant Loma. And ever since then, they've had Anthony Notarmaso. Wow. Mm-hmm. How do we pronounce that guy's name? So the debut is... basically, they had a few demos lying around before this, and then they... Okay, so to preface even this before, After the Burial has kind of generally been the brainchild of Trent Halfdahl and Justin Lowe, the guitar players. Mm-hmm. And, like, their interplay, both in the music and in the, like, video... If you watch all the videos they make for, like, pre-production and stuff and all, like... them just fucking around. Like, it's clearly their brainchild. They write a majority of the music and they produce it themselves. In fact, Justin programmed the drums on the demos, and he produced the albums as well. So, like, After the Burial is Trent and Justin, or, well, was, and we'll get to that.
Sadly, yeah.
Yeah. So, the demos are actually, like, unlistenable garbage. The production is really bad, but it has, like, some of the key songs that ended up on Forging a Future Self.
Which is a fantastic album, by the way.
Yes. So the production is maybe a bit, 2006 metalcore.
So before we actually dive into this album, I just want to take that, you know, what you just said about the production and say that you can't really talk about After the Burial without talking about production. Because mm-hmm. that's kind of been the controversy around this band. And yeah. Honestly, I feel like I'm going to say something that's maybe controversial. To the crowds that we hang out with. Yeah. Production is super overrated nowadays. Super duper overrated, and people give it a much larger weight in their musical consumption than they should. It's important. It's important that it matches the sound that you're going for and that it's not absolute garbage. But honestly, there's so much good music with, production that is on an objective scale subpar, but people are nowadays spoiled. They're unable to listen past production, and it's a real shame. And this is a perfect example of that, because this album is so interesting.
Yeah.
It has so many ideas that are just musically amazing. And it doesn't sound that great, but you can still enjoy it.
Yeah. And, like, the vocals of Nick Wellner are pretty interesting and unique for the scene. He has this, like, high shrieky yell that I've actually kind of adapted in some of my stuff because I love the sound of this album. Like, on Fingers Like Daggers, he rolls his R's, which is, like, a really cool thing that only I've also heard Mikhail from Dark Tranquility do. That's a really cool sound. So on this album, they have, I feel like this is in some ways the prototype for the Rareform sound, but also its own thing. Like, Rareform developed on some of the elements of this, but also didn't follow up on some of it.
Yeah.
So this, like, is a really unique sound. But go ahead.
Yeah, I feel like this is the heaviest album, I think. Not heavy. Well, it's a different kind of heavy. The other albums really double down on the breakdowns and stuff like that. But on this album, it goes faster. It feels harder in some way. Especially the drums, which is kind of interesting. Like, the drums are way heavier than stuff that comes later. And also,
I think peak drumming is Rareform, but maybe that's like, there's more songs with blast beats on Rareform, but yeah, I see what you mean.
It's not even blast beats. It's just what they do within the structure of the track. The tracks just feel a lot more direct and a lot heavier. I prefer Rareform, by the way. I feel like Rareform is my favorite album of theirs. Although I basically liked everything I heard. But I think Rareform is the better album, but something about,
it's like the raw kind of, not having figured out what you exactly want to do yet kind of vibe.
And also the vocals, I mean, they really make this album. They sound so unique. There really isn't anybody else that I've heard. It almost goes into guttural territories at points, like the lows are really on the verge of guttural stuff. It's interesting. I like them. It would have been interesting, you know, an alternate timeline.
Yeah.
Where Wellner stayed in After the Burial. But I still feel like yeah, the production is outdated and stuff like that, but this is a super legit album that is also interesting from a historical perspective.
Interesting fact is that Justin wrote a lot of the drums on this album.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I don't want to say stupid shit like, you know, guitarists drumming. there are differences, but it's too personal to say. So like, you know, it's too wide of a brushstroke, but that does make sense. Once you say it, I'm like, oh yeah, I can see how that happens.
So the album kind of pioneered their sound as like neoclassical shred plus metalcore.
Yeah.
And then they kind of follow that up with like more Meshuggah influenced sounds later on in other albums. But this album didn't have that much Meshuggah influence. It was just like a lot of shred plus like mid-2000s metalcore. And I feel like Engulfed, which is one of the like underrated tracks on this album, is a prototype for the song Ometh on Rare Form, which we'll get to in a second. But otherwise, like on this album, they do a few things that they didn't do for quite a while later. Like Fingers Like Daggers has like the clean singing in the chorus.
Yep.
And a bunch of like clean interludes and stuff. And of course, I don't know if you know this, but the opening intro track, Pi, the Mercury God of Infinity, the chug pattern in that is actually like the digits of Pi.
Yeah, I've heard that. That's like a factoid you always hear about these guys.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And, you know, and, it's just a funny nerd thing, right? It doesn't have too much meaning, but yeah, it's cool.
That sets the tone for these things because, like, if you listen to some of their like video diaries of them making the stuff, like they actually like care about the numericity of their riffing and stuff, and like it. Making it kind of intentionally air quotes mathy, right? Like they care about the number patterns and making some things sound offbeat while still sounding like headbangable. So that kind of, you know, sets the tone for their entire career in a sense.
And I think, you know, we use the term timelines a lot. And I just want to imagine a timeline in which this became Sumerian core instead of Veil of Maya's later work. You know, where super technical and shreddy metalcore became Sumerian core and not as many breakdowns, like the China symbol or whatever, and like the bro attitude. That would have been amazing. You know, if it's funny to say if After the Burial became bigger because there may be the Sumerian band, right? Together with Born of Osiris. But if kind of these influences won out, instead of bands who pretend that their vocalists were kidnapped to promote albums. shade. #shade. Yeah. if you don't know what that is, then just Google it. It's a fantastic story. Things would have been better. And you know, when Sumerian released, the EP, This Life Is All We Have, like the press statement said, that Forging a Future Self is a groundbreaking album which helped shape the sound of modern metal. And I'm like, yeah, guys, maybe you should have, you know,
pushed it more.
Yeah, exactly. Pushed it more, pushed that direction, signed bands that didn't just try and ape the heavier parts, but also understood, you know, the technicality and the more, like early Veil of Maya, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The first, the second Veil of Maya album. Not id, but, fuck. The Common Man's Collapse.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah. Such a good album. Yes. Oh my God.
Yep. And like, I feel like that and Rare Form and Faceless's Akeldama and Border of Osiris's New Reign, that was like the big four at the time. That was like amazing.
For sure. Yeah. Okay. Big four. All right. We got to talk about Rare Form, right?
Yes. Now then we get to Rare Form. So Rare Form originally released with Grant on vocals and the rest of the list. Lineup stays, I think, the same. Well, no, they get a new drummer, and then they get another new drummer, and like, so they have a bit of a drummer shuffle during that time.
Yeah,
but like the guitar players, the bass players stay same. And then we get Rare Form, and Rare Form is fucking amazing. It's incredible.
One of modern metal's best albums.
Every song is just classic, like. I can't. So from the opening of Berserker, like the moment I heard that song, I was like, holy shit. Like this is because like when this album came out, right? Meshuggah had been using eight strings for like a year or two. And like people were starting to like be the meme of like, oh, yeah, just get 8 strings and chug on the low string, or just get 7 strings and chug on the low string. And this album was just like a big fuck you to that, because like they shredded hard, and also they used like the entirety of the instrument. And Berserker was like is a song that immediately from the beginning that just does all of it. And it's amazing. And the lyrics on this album are like super cool too. Like nobody is slacking on this album. It's just great.
And I listened to this album while, well, I did most of my quote unquote research for this piece while working. Mm-hmm. You know, I played this in the background. And Berserker and Drift and Cursing Achenaten, or however you pronounce that. they're good songs. But I think when I stopped, what I was doing was when the title track came on.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, you know, that little pull that they do on the yep. first riff, I was just like, whoa, wait, what the fuck was that? It's not super technical. It's not like, how do they do this? Just the composition, like the melody does something really catchy there. And mm-hmm. I remember thinking to myself, you know, I had heard the song before, but it's been a few years. And suddenly I was listening to it and I was like, this is the best that metalcore has sounded in mm-hmm. fucking ages. You know, even the great bands for metalcore, like August Burns Red and stuff like that, they have like maybe 4 or 5 moments like this. And I feel like this entire album is like one huge, that lead is going to be stuck in my head for a fucking week now. And I found myself, you know, like driving to work and like whistling the fucking lead to this title track. It's so catchy. It's just really a phenomenal album. It's really hard to overstate. It kind of feels like the perfect sophomore effort, because it takes mm-hmm. what was so good about the debut. It refines it. It focuses it, but it doesn't lose that hunger. Right?
Yeah.
We spoke about that, you know, remember ages ago, like the first year when we spoke with, was it David? Where we spoke about why bands are better when they're young and it's their first album.
Yeah.
So here it's like a good example of how to not lose that fierceness, that hunger.
And the thing is, like, we praise the leads, but also the breakdowns are super high effort too.
Yeah, for sure.
Like,
it's not just, you know,
they're memorable, they're interesting, and they're not just like, you know, 1-2, wait.
Yeah.
1-2, 1-2, 1-2, wait. Like, they're actually like really interesting. They keep the song moving. They don't feel shoehorned in. And like, man, Cursing Akhenaten and Aspiration are like just amazing. Like the thing is, like, they're not the most shreddy songs, but they're the most like memorable songs of the genre in general.
Yeah.
And like, they're always good live. They always play those two live.
And I feel, you know, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Ometh.
Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite songs of all time. That's just fucking, oh my god.
I think like the first thing that caught me when I listened to it, that opening riff is like a really ballsy move, because it's basically thrash.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a thrash riff. It's not even like metalcore that's doing thrash and just pretending that it's modern. Like if you told me that this was fucking, I don't know, like, it can't be Metallica, because it doesn't sound exactly like that. But if this was like a thrash mm-hmm. band in the early 90s, I'd be like, yeah, sure, I can see that. and I think that sets the tone for the entire track. And also, especially this track, if you read the lyrics, it kind mm-hmm. of foreshadows stuff that we're going to talk about. You know, mental states and, depression stuff. Although I feel like the moment that clicked for me when I was doing my, again, quote unquote, research for this, was in Dreams.
Mm-hmm.
You know which part I'm talking about. I Don't Exist.
Yeah.
Yep. But here as well, like, I'm falling away from myself, from who I used to be. Arid skin, cracked and torn. Like, this entire, the outer shell is decomposing. And here it's still optimistic, right? Releasing a new upgrade itself. But it's still
yep.
that kind of language, which is all about breakdowns, not musical breakdowns, mental breakdowns, and releasing demons and stuff like that. It's a lot of foreshadowing for stuff that came later. And it's super powerful now.
And like structurally too, like the song, the way it evolves, and it ends in this like amazing solo, one of my favorite solos of all time, and this like super melodic thing. I don't know if you noticed, but like this song's structure is something that I try to do in like most of the songs that I write.
Interesting.
Like it, and, And like structurally, I always try to kind of follow this pattern. And like a lot of my songs end in this like melodic kind of everything coming together kind of sound. And like the lyrical pattern progression is also something that I felt like this song is just, man, I'm so in love with the song.
The solo in this is fantastic. It really reminds me of a different solo. I'll try and figure it out. Like the end, the very last few notes that are super shreddy. They go almost like digital. First of all, I love that trick. A lot of soloists do that trick. But here it really sounds like something else. I'll need to put my finger on it.
This kind of reminds me of, reverse reminds me, I guess. Majoring in the Minors by August Burns Red has a similar structure, ends in a similar melodic plus solo fashion. Like, that's also why I like that song so much, because it reminds me of this song.
I'll tell you what it reminds me of. It reminds me of Dragon Force.
Yeah.
That very end of the solo where he goes so fast that it sounds almost MIDI. that's very Dragon Force.
And, like, I've seen After the Burial live many times, and like seeing this live, the trade off is just like amazing.
Yeah.
It's like such a cool moment.
This might be a good time to point out something that you always say, how good these guys are live.
They're amazing live. So like when I first came to the States, I've seen a bunch of bands live and I was like, oh yeah, this is really cool. But then I saw After the Burial live and they sound so fucking heavy. Like their live sound is just crushingly powerful, and they're all like super into it. So obviously I didn't get to see them before Anthony. I've always seen them with Anthony, and like Anthony's an amazing live vocalist, by the way. Every member in the band is so into it. It's like, and the trade-offs, they're so fucking tight. Like it's ridiculous. Their sound is amazing, their presence is amazing, they're like an incredible live band. And also I have like one cute memory. I saw them the first time I saw them live was in a like small bar in Baltimore, and like they were playing Aspiration, and you know how like in the middle of the song like it stops and then it starts doing like the breakdown pattern, right?
Yeah,
like like that part, right? And like Justin was doing that part and I was like shaking my hand in the pattern in the air, and he was like looking at me, but then I messed up somewhere and he just like closed his eyes and shook his head and like, dude, nah, you fucked up. It was so cool. It was like,
that's amazing.
Really cool moment for me. Yeah.
Cool.
So then what happened is a year after Rareform, Grant, the vocalist, left the band and the drummer Dan joined the band, and this was like After the Burial's lineup for a good while, like the lineup was finalized, and they re-recorded the album. Re-recorded. Just
before that, to give a bit of context, like why they maybe re-recorded some tracks. What was I gonna say? Fuck. Oh, this is when they went really big.
Yeah.
They toured with Veil of Maya, and they toured with Suicide Silence, and this is pre-Shenanigans Suicide Silence. This is like at their peak, right? Peak of...
They appeared on Saints Row. Berserker was on Saints Row 3.
Yeah, and Veil of Maya in 2009, right?
Yeah.
This is like right after Common Man's Collapse. So this is the height of fucking Sumerian Core, and these guys
They were on Summer Slaughter.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, and then you have the lineup change, which is very interesting. You know, to consider the timing, what happened there. And maybe it goes back to what you said about, you know, Justin and Trent being kind of the heart, and maybe some of the other members not being the same level of committed. And just think about that. This is a fun band that you joined, and maybe you started it in high school and you joined later, or maybe you've been there since day one. Suddenly it's a job.
Yeah.
Like you're touring, you're away from your family, labels, deals, all that shit. So it's interesting to consider the shakeup in that regard. Yeah.
So, and also Anthony is a very different vocalist from Grant. So Grant was a really expressive vocalist. He had like so many different voices that he used on Rareform. And I think like Grant's voice is a big part of what makes the album so effective, because his delivery is just ridiculous on so many of the parts. So iconic for me, at least, right? And so when Anthony joined, he has a completely different style. They decided to redo the album. So some people don't like the production on the original album. And some people prefer the new version. I personally really don't like the new version. The only thing I like about the new version is at the end of Cursing Akhenaten, the breakdown is slightly different in that they, in the original version, it fades out with like the notes constantly going. In the re-release version, they play it how they play it live, where they like do syncopation at the end. Mm-hmm. And it fades out like that. So I think that's like the only thing that the new version has over the original. Beyond that, so Anthony, you know, he has just joined the band. He is still kind of figuring out the ropes, and he's like supposed to replace a vocalist that is a totally different style. And like he's doing lines that weren't written for him, yeah. Right? So I think this is his weakest performance. It just doesn't work. Like he doesn't have the same level of expressiveness that Grant has. And he's also trying to express like things that are like, you know, not his thing, right? And they also redid the drums. And I think like they apparently they did like live drums, but they then like sample replaced it with like generic Superior Drummer sounds. And like, well, obviously the drums in the original are not like super realistic. They were in fact programmed by Justin, by the way. Mm-hmm. But their sound fits better because I think the original sound of the album is so much more mechanical. And that to me kind of fits with the vibe of the album so much. Like this whole super tight machine that is generating this insanely crushing music. That just like is so much more powerful to me than the re-release, which just feels kind of sloppy.
Yeah, I could take either one, to be honest. I don't feel as passionate as you do about these releases. But at the end of the day, when I go to listen to this album, I'll probably listen to the original. Just because, I don't know, maybe anachronistic of me or even conservative. I just kind of want to feel what the band were going for when they made the album.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like, obviously, a lot of the production there was born of limitation, just like any new band, mm-hmm. you know, doing their debut. But I'd like to think that some of it was also intended,
yeah,
and was meant to create kind of that vibe. So I would listen to the original rather than the production, the re-release, just on that merit. The production on the new one is the newer one, I should say, is fine. I think it was necessary.
I think the vocals are the big problem.
Yeah, obviously.
Problem mainly.
I agree. And I just don't feel like it was necessary at all.
Yeah.
Which kind of goes back to what I said at the beginning. Like, people make such a mess out of production. I don't think this was necessary. But I obviously understand both, like, the contextual reasons behind it because of the new vocalist. And also mm-hmm. from a business perspective. You know, Rareform explodes and then you can, you know, you can keep milking that kind of momentum.
Yeah.
I see where they were coming from when they did this. And I don't mean that as a criticism, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I obviously feel super passionately about this, but Rareform is also like, I don't know, super personal and
yeah.
I love the album so much. And I think like I could live with the production, but the vocals are just non-negotiable for me because like Grant's delivery is just something else on this album.
Yeah.
So the thing about Anthony is, and we're going to move on to the next album. Anthony is, at first I hated him because of the re-release of Rareform, right?
Yeah.
But if you see them live, Anthony is an amazing vocalist. He's so active on stage. He sounds so good live. He's super, super good. But on album, it never comes through. I don't know what they do to his vocals production-wise on albums because he never sounds that good on album. But live, he's incredible, which is often the case. Like, it's often the opposite. Case,
yeah,
with sure. a lot of metal vocalists. So yeah,
the question is like, where does it get lost?
Yeah, you know, I think in the production somewhere they just kind of put something on his voice that kind of squashes it, and it just doesn't carry the same energy.
Yeah,
I don't know. All right, and then we have In Dreams, and I kind of hate this album. I like it, but I hate it, and I have. Like, I actively hate it because I have, like, 5 fucking copies of this album. It's just miserable. I hate it so much.
Wait, yeah. Why do you hate this album?
Because I love Rareform so much, and it kind of, it is their album that I think is most different from the rest of their albums.
Yeah.
And it also coincided with a lot of other Sumerian bands kind of going in this type of direction.
Yeah.
So it was like the moment of like, oh, we're all doing this now. Okay, this genre is dead.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, it's definitely a chuggier album, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, to the point that I don't think there's really a shreddy song on this album.
So I didn't anticipate you saying that, but it fits perfectly into what I want to say. You know, just let's put the entire album aside. I just want to shout out 5 Seconds.
Mm-hmm.
158 on Breadcrumbs and White Stones.
Oh yeah, that song is like the only exception.
Holy fuck. When like Anthony goes super low and then there's this shred that leads into the next part. That part, go listen to it right now. Just go to that part. It's just so fucking good. First of all, the shred is amazing. And then not really a breakdown, but there's this chug that follows it. There's no other way for me to like convey what I feel other than hyped.
Yeah.
It just makes me fucking hyped. It really makes you want to mosh, want to move. It's a super well written part. And like you said, in general, this track is really, really good.
It was the first track they released from the album, by the way, back in the day. So I was really hyped. And I have like about 1,000 listens of that song on Last.fm.
Yeah, it's a really good track. I kind of enjoyed In Dreams, but I think for better or for worse, it's one of the albums I least remember.
Over the years, I kind of warmed up on it, but like when I first listened to it, I was like, okay, when is it, you know, when is it going to happen? And then when I got to the end, Encased in Ice started, and like the first vocal line of the song was, motherfucker, come on. I just fucking threw the CD out of, like, just threw this, no joke. Like, I just legitimately threw the CD. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, even if, you know, the following album is the controversial one, right?
Nah, not really. I think after this album, the band kind of never reached the same level of popularity anymore, so it's not really particularly controversial anymore. I would say that this album is kind of like, I guess the controversial one, because like, you know, this is where people, this was like the Make It or Break It album for them, and it broke it for a lot of people. So
wait, isn't the next one the one with the production?
Yeah.
Where everybody hated on it.
Yeah, but like, there was a lot less people there to hate on it, if
yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. So, In Dreams, like, at least Wolves Within left some sort of impact on me. Mm-hmm. In Dreams kind of like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Except for that one fucking, those 5 seconds.
To be fair.
Amazing.
To give them credit, like, this album is really chuggy. But the chugs are super good. Like, My Frailty is one of their best songs. Your yeah. Troubles Will Cease and Fortune Will Smile Upon You is also fucking amazing. And they tried, like, ballad-type songs on Pendulum on To Carry You Away, and they're pretty good. But, like, it's just not what I want from this band.
Yeah, I agree.
So, there's not much to say about this album. So, yeah. Cool. Like, it's, in hindsight, it's not as bad as my initial reaction. But, like, it's just, I think it's their least interesting album, least memorable album. Just,
I agree.
Whatever. But, like, again, My Frailty, Your Fortunes, those are songs they always play live because they're just super good live. I saw them play them live and it's just like, you know, it's totally different live. But that doesn't make for a good album. And Breadcrumbs is a really cool song, but that's pretty much it. And then we have the EP, This Life Is All We Have, which is essentially a remake of 3 songs from Forging a Future Self.
Yeah,
With Anthony, like completely new production. And also like they use the 8 strings on some of the parts of some of the breakdowns. It's a steady decline, Fingers Like Daggers and Redeeming the Wretched. I would say instead of Redeeming the Wretched, I would pick either Engulfed or The Forfeit or the title track, Forging mm-hmm. a Future Self. But Steady Decline and Fingers Like Daggers are solid picks. And by the way, I don't know if you know this, but on Fingers Like Daggers, Nick makes a return on the chorus for the clean singing.
I actually couldn't listen to this album because it's blocked in Israel. although all the other Sumerian stuff isn't. So I don't know what the fuck. Maybe it's like a distribution thing. Yeah, but I couldn't listen to this.
production is, funnily, this is the best they've ever sounded.
That's a shame. Yeah.
So I guess I'll just comment on this. It's super good. Like, it's basically, if they redid the entire Forging a Future Self with this, I would be super happy. It's amazing. Like, it's just a net improvement over the original. Even Anthony sounds totally at home doing Nick's lines for the most part. Unlike him trying to do Grant's lines on rare form. He doesn't, like, roll his R's on fingers like daggers, but he kind of brings his own intensity. So I'm happy. Like, Nick's returning for the clean vocals on the chorus of Fingers Like Daggers is a pretty cool little thing. Like, you know, it shows that, you know, there's just no bad blood. It's a really nice throwback. It's super great. I recommend finding a way to listen to it or whatever. Like, it's just, yeah, it's basically the best they've ever, I said that already. It's the best they've ever sounded. They replaced some of the breakdowns with, like, 8 strings, so it sounds heavier. It's amazing. Like, I would be so happy if they did the whole album like this.
I'll do some digging. I'll bet I can find it somewhere.
All right. So great job to him on that. But then, within the same year later, we have Walls Within.
Yeah.
So I feel like this is where the band hits some sort of, like, production troubles or something like this, because it sounds a lot worse than the EP. And I think, like, I don't remember very clearly, but there was some sort of kerfuffle around the release of this of, like, was it rushed or something like that? I don't know. Because the production isn't great. Like, it's not the same type of bad as Forging a Future Self. Forging a Future Self is, you know, them just not having the budget. This one is kind of just minimal effort production, right?
Yeah.
That being said, I think this album is really good. Put it in, like, top three.
It has really good ideas. I think beyond the production, I kind of have a problem with how some things are put together. Like, some of it is kind of jarring, right? It doesn't flow as well as the previous works. It's still good when you, like, you take snippets, it sounds great, and some of the ideas, especially the guitar ideas, are really interesting. But something just doesn't flow as well as the previous ones.
It does feel thrown together.
Yeah, exactly. It feels rushed. Which is kind of weird. But it's still worth your time, I feel. It's a good album. I enjoyed listening to it.
So it has, like, Anti-Pattern is a super strong opener. It's really heavy. Like, the shitty superior drummer sound in the good beginning is not great, but, like, it makes up for it with, like, just how ridiculous and heavy it is.
Yeah.
A Fearful Men was the first song they released, and it's, like, a really cool kind of thrashy, shreddy thing, which is, you know, it shows that they still got that. Pennyweight, like, I think Paris is, like, the song that I care the least about on this album.
Yeah, that's another thing I wanted to say. It's the longest album, even though it's only by, like, 6 minutes from In Dreams. It's 11 minutes longer than the debut, and it's 10 minutes longer than Rare Form and stuff like that. And I feel like there was definitely 2 tracks you could cut out of this, which would have made the album much more cohesive and more punchy. So Paris and also Neo Seol.
Those two you can get rid of.
And because they're the 7th and the 8th, that is totally usually indicative of, oh no, we only have 7 tracks. We need 2 more. Oh, here are some guitar ideas I had around. Let's just cobble them together into a track and throw it on the album.
And I feel like the album should open with A Wolf Amongst Ravens.
Oh yeah, that's really true. That's such a good song. It's amazing.
And it has, like, a really good, like, fade in too. So, like, it's way better than the shittily produced drum opening of Anti-Pattern. Like, that's just so confusing when you first listen. I was like, what is going on? Like, but again, they bring Nick back for the Virga on this one. And, like, not like a lot of, so the thing is, I like Anti-Pattern, Fearful Men, Pennyweight, and A Wolf Amongst Ravens. And then for Disconnect, Nine Summers, and Virga, I think they have good riffs, but they're not, like you said, as well put together. That being said, I still, like, jam to this album regularly. I think it's super cool. Even if it kind of drags with Neo Soul and Paris, I think overall it's, like, a good listening experience.
Yeah, I agree. It's a solid album.
Now, Yeah. Now we come to the hard part. So, well, first of all, and we cover this in the podcast, Justin put out a video on YouTube called My Demo Reel. It's like a 30-minute long thing. It has a bunch of ideas, like half songs in there. It also has the entirety of Anti-Pattern without vocals, but then with like funny samples throughout, and it's pretty funny. It has some really cool stuff in there, and it's like a mini After the Burial EP almost. Like you could cut that up into a few parts, and it will just be a totally cool instrumental EP, I think. And so it has a song that later ends up on their latest album, Laurentian Ghosts. So that was pretty cool. I thought that was really fun. And then a month later, the thing happened where, you know, first Justin posted a weird rant on social media about, you know, how everybody's conspiring against him, which actually sounds like there was a name for that syndrome where... what's it called? Like, where you think like people in your life have been replaced? By imposters.
Fuck yeah, it's a really fucked up thing. Something with C.
Yeah, I feel like it's C. Copgrad delusion.
Yeah, exactly. But
well, I maybe that's him, not.
It kind of went farther.
Yeah,
because it was just like, you know, they're stealing my ideas, and the label is stealing my ideas, and everybody's misrepresenting my music and who I am and stuff like that.
Yeah, and he said he's quitting the band, and so he posted this rant, and the band shortly after said, you know, Justin has been struggling with mental illness, and they've been trying to help him, but this came out of the blue for them, and yeah. So shortly after, you know, it was posted that Justin is lost, like he was declared officially missing, and later that day he was found dead by a bridge in Minnesota. So yeah, that was like a really, really fucked up thing, I guess.
I think it was especially fucked up, you know. I want to tie this into something else. This week I've been listening a lot to what's his name? Mike Shinoda.
Mm-hmm. Post-traumatic EP. Yeah, we'll talk about that later.
And like, if you have a hard time with trauma and loss, don't listen to the EP. Just fucking don't. Because it's him basically falling apart over Chester's death. And it came to me because there's the fucking terrible, awful cliche of the writing was on the wall. And once something like this happens, you can't help but dig back and look at lyrics and read between the lines. And like I said about that line from In Dreams, which track is it from? I don't remember now.
Breadcrumbs.
Breadcrumbs, right. So there's this super raw part when Anthony screams, "I don't exist," over and over again. And like, you can't not listen to that now and tie that into Justin's issues of, you know, misrepresentation and feeling like he's been betrayed and misplaced his trust and stuff like that. And
also, I mean, the very song, "Your Troubles Will Cease and Fortune Will Smile Upon You."
Yeah, I feel like that's a reference. But in any case, he was very active in the community. He wasn't someone who took a back seat. People knew who he was. You know, people from
he was a funny guy. Like, if you watch their videos, he was, you know, energetic, lively, and, you know, just memeing along with Trent.
And it was so close to us as well, because William wrote that tour diary, if you recall, with them. Like, they were friends, really close friends. Yeah. They had spent a few weeks together. And I know that Dan also met him a few times.
Like, I've spoken with him a few times too, yeah.
So like, people from our circle, that's the thing about these bands. They never got big enough to have that distance from people like us. You know, people who are fans but also have an inside the community and the industry, stuff like that. I know people who have selfies with this guy. You know what I'm saying? It just hit so close to home. And I remember we spoke about it on the podcast, you know, the whole thing of the artist and mental illness and how it feeds into creativity and how it feeds into the cycle. And I don't know if Wolves Within had something to do with it. The reception, maybe both the reception to that and in Dreams. I'm obviously not blaming anyone, right? Mm-hmm. Just saying, you know, living in that environment where you used to be this the shit, and now there's a ton of people out there who feel like you've lost your way. These are really difficult issues for anyone to deal with. And if you had a history of mental illness, it would impact you even harder. Yeah, so this story was really, really hard and still is, I feel.
Yeah.
And the band released Dig Deep.
Yeah, so if they were already working on it, but obviously Justin's death threw a wrench in that quite a bit. And this was one of those bands where it's like a day job. Well, it is, but also they're all really close brothers, like by all accounts. They're super close, especially Trent and Justin, but also like the rest of the band too. Like they really were best friends. They spent their lives together. Like, so, you know, Justin's death was like a huge blow to the band. Like if you go watch, and we talked about this on the podcast before, like they were supposed to be on the Sumerian Summer Slaughter tour, and obviously they dropped out. But when the tour stopped by their local area, whatever, they got on stage without instruments, and you know they gave a short speech about, you know, how they're not giving up, they're not going on, and Justin would have wanted them to continue and stuff like that. And it was like, you know, really powerful. So, yeah, they put out Dig Deep. Apparently, they just made this album in a month. Like, wrote it and recorded it in a month. And, yes, it's, I don't think it's their best album, but they said that, you know, it was really hard to make this album, and they really had to dig deep within themselves to find the motivation to go on. And the album cover kind of represents, you know, that tiny light lying within them that was, you know, they had to dig really hard to find that light within the darkness.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So two tracks on this album have a little bit of history. The Endless March, actually, if you go back before Wolves Within in the pre-production videos, they play that song. That song was supposed to end up on Wolves Within, but it never did. And I was like, it sounds super cool. And I was like, where is this song? I want to hear it. And when it finally came out on this one, I was pretty happy to hear it. So that song has been in the tank for a while. And also, Laurentian Ghosts. So this song was on Justin's demo, but also it has a little bit more backstory. Apparently, this song, the first few riffs in the song, is what Justin always played during soundcheck live. It just was like, you know, a riff that he really liked to play. So they decided to turn that into a song. And so the title of the song actually refers to the Laurentian Divide, mm-hmm. which, you know, separates the country, but also Minnesota,
yeah,
into half. And yeah, so this album is obviously a pretty heavy album. Like, well, it's heavy as like metal, but also heavy in terms of themes.
Yeah.
For very obvious reasons. And this album also feels kind of like, well, musically speaking, not their best. I like it the second least, I guess. But there's also some really cool tracks in there. It just feels like they really had to dig deep to come up with some of this stuff, unfortunately. And at first I was kind of not very hot on this album, but since then I've again warmed up to it. And Collapse is super tight. Lost in the Static is cool. Mire, Deluge, Laurentian Ghosts, and The Endless March. So about, you know, the same ratio of stuff I like on this album as much as I like on Wolves Within, but also so the production is much better. It has a lot of, again, chuggy stuff, so it's kind of like in Dreams in that sense. But it also kind of does the chugging is more interesting than in Dreams for sure. So shortly after this album, Lee left the band, citing, you know, he just wanted to focus on his family. And I don't blame him at all. Like, you know, it's hard to kind of continue after a loss like that. You know, they try to continue, but, you know, it's probably not the same. And it's just too much for him to deal with. And I totally respect that. So they got a new bass player And obviously they only have one guitar player now, Trent, and he's, you know, playing to a backing track now. And I don't know, like, he just doesn't seem the same, like, live. I don't know if this is me kind of projecting, but, like, he, I don't know. He feels like, well, obviously something is missing, right? Like, he just doesn't have the same vibrant energy anymore. He has a more somber energy on stage. So,
your troubles will cease and fortune will smile upon you is actually from Stay, a 2005 movie. It's quite good, by the way. Ewan McGregor, Ryan Gosling, before he blew up, and Naomi Watts, and Bob Hoskins, and all sorts of people, about a psychiatrist trying to prevent his patient from committing suicide. And the patient, Henry Latham, played by Ryan Gosling, he says that's his line. So I don't know how it wound up as a title or what the connection is there. But that's pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just did some digging.
You dug deep?
Yeah, you always know just what to say.
This is the first album that was not produced by Justin and Trent. Well, obviously not Justin, but not Trent either. They actually got Will Putney to produce this together with themselves.
Yeah. Okay.
So, well, you didn't say anything about this album. How do you feel about this one?
I don't know. I kind of feel like it's elevated from comment. You know what I'm saying? Like it's sacrosanct in some way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's definitely not their best album. Mm-hmm. But also, I can't even fucking imagine needing to release something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's very indicative that, you know, Lee left and stuff like that. It's just how do you come back from that? And it kind of feels like, well, the band still exists, right?
They're still touring.
They're still touring, and they have Andrian has joined them as a full-time member. They're still going, and I expect them to release something soon.
Maybe this year, hopefully.
Yeah, but it kind of feels like the last shot of an era. How do you judge that, like?
How do you even, like, write an album after this that's also, like, how do you even write this, right? So,
yeah.
Exactly. I mean, if you criticize this album for, you know, feeling like something is missing, yeah.
I feel like, it's definitely something you need to take into context. And it kind of ties a bow around this whole question of, you know, the context of music, how it exists in relation to, you know, the life of the artists surrounding it.
So, by the way, as of Lee leaving, Trent is now the only remaining original member of the band. But at this point, Anthony could almost be considered like Anthony is a big part of the DNA of the band, and also the drummer Dan Carl. So it's not as bad as it sounds on paper. So I feel like After the Burial is, I think, I want to say a great band. They've made great music, but like the things have, like, things have never aligned for them except for Rare Form, I think. And if things aligned for them, they could do so much better. But it feels like always kind of something goes wrong for them.
Something is missing just, you know, just before it goes great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It will be interesting to see what they do next, if they do make another album. Presumably they will, because they've decided to continue what that album will sound like. Because I feel like, you know, Dig Deep was an album that they had to make, and they had to get it out of their system. And now, you know, it's been some time has passed, right? So it will be interesting to see how they write songs now, because that's like songwriting in a state of crisis, right?
Yeah.
Whereas this one, yeah, we'll see. I don't know. It's hard to say. I do not envy Trent. I'll say that.
No, for sure. Yeah, so much pressure. I feel like at the end of this, what I want to say is, for better and for worse, After the Burial are not the quintessential metalcore, Sumerian core band, but definitely one of the trajectories that this scene has taken. The way their albums progress, kind of the disappointment, that later turns out not to be such a huge disappointment. Mm-hmm. It's true for other bands as well within the genre. Bone of Osiris, for example. The way their music transformed as they went along. And also, yeah, the issues with mental health and breakdowns and the issues with production and the issues with re-releases and different vocalists. It's a very interesting case to do a deep dive on. There's so much going on here. So many dynamics and interactions. It's a really, really interesting band that I feel like a lot of, I'm going to self-deprecate, like people from my end of the music journalism spectrum don't give enough credit to. It's kind of easy to kind of hand wave that period and be a hipster and only listen to Mercenary because that was when metalcore was actually good. Mercenary, great, by the way, but regardless.
The fucking shit line of, oh, Converge is my favorite metalcore band. Fuck off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or not even touch the genre, you know, just say metalcore sucks and
which is bullshit. By the way, that's the same thing as saying Converge is your favorite metalcore band.
Shots fired. But I feel like if you take an honest look at these bands and you sit down and listen to their discography, like I did with Bone of Osiris a while ago, there's plenty here to love.
Yeah.
There's something here for anyone who loves heavy music. And there's a fucking reason why a generation of, and I'm not saying this in a derogatory manner, a generation of middle and high schoolers grew up on these bands. It's not a fucking accident. It's not a fucking, because they don't know music, blah, 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 blah. There's some really good, impactful, emotional stuff in here. And if you consider yourself passionate about modern metal, you absolutely cannot skip these bands in this period. And yep. This label, by the way, we give Sumerian a lot of shit, but they're essential to understanding where metal is today, for better and for worse.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, they keep making big moves. For example, they put out a new Jonathan Davis single. They're making an album with Jonathan Davis. They have Ash Evelson's movie, American Satan. Yeah. No, but like they had Dillinger Escape Plan, but oh, that band died. I'm so sad. They have Between the Buried and Me Now, The Faceless, which again, like the thing, what's weird is like a lot of the really important, in my opinion, bands on Sumerian have all kind of had rocky careers.
Yeah, and are now either they've flickered away or are flickering away.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I don't know. We're going to have to talk about Sumerian seriously at some point. Yep. But you can't ignore it. You can't ignore that label. You can't ignore the artists on it. And you shouldn't. There's really good music on the, you know, past the bands who use their vocalists' alleged kidnapping as a promotional tool.
Like Borgor, for example.
Is he on Sumerian?
Yep.
Oh, God. Jesus. Yeah. Fuck that guy. Okay. I don't think we're going to do more news this week.
We can do like a couple of short things. Like, I just want to mention a few things, if that's okay.
Okay, okay, really, yeah, go on.
So, Grammys are happening. Avenged Sevenfold has decided that they're protesting it because rock gets no respect. And at surface level, this sounds like, oh, you know, the typical fucking rock audience and like some dad comment. But actually, if you look into it, it makes kind of sense to me, I think, because, well, first of all, they're not even televising the Rock Awards. So, like, you know, if you go, you're going to be going for, like, basically to get sidelined. And also, like, it will cost them so much to travel and stay there and whatnot. Like, the number he quotes is $150,000. So, despite them winning, like, Best Rock Song, they're not going. And I think that's completely fair, and I totally understand.
I mean, this is a good example of why I don't like Shadows, because there's a perfectly good message here being filtered through his fucking stage personality. And he had to like say it like this instead of saying, you know, like even the tweet, honored, full stop. Unfortunately, they have taken Best Rock Song off the telecast this year, so we won't be attending. Maybe next time. Like, don't fucking do that. Release like a proper statement saying, this is wrong. This shouldn't happen. It's just another sign of how
To be fair, he did say that in an interview.
No, but he said Rock Song of the Year can't get 2 minutes, and they put us in some side venue no one gives a fuck about. Fuck that waste of time and money. Like, you have a stage, you have an opportunity to say something, and instead it's all like, my name is Shadows. I will a Satan show. Like, fuck off, man. Just, you know, I do agree with the point. Like, you can't expect a band to pay, they claim, $150,000. And if that sounds wild to you, just imagine having to ship all that stuff by plane, you know, the equipment and themselves and all the roadies, and bands need that shit.
And they have to stay somewhere. And also, they're probably not going to be making money in the time frame where they're going to be doing this instead.
Yeah, exactly. There's like the money that they're losing not doing other shit. And then you're going to tell them that they're not, it's not even going to be televised. So what? They're going to just play a free show that they're not getting paid for in front of who? Like rich people and their spouses.
An audience that doesn't care.
Yeah, an audience that doesn't give a fuck. It obviously doesn't care about fucking Avenged Sevenfold. And you know, the other nominations, Metallica, Foo Fighters, who the fuck is K-Flay and nothing more. I don't know, but like, yeah, sure. You could say, oh, the stage, the occasion, but Avenged Sevenfold are huge. They don't need the prestige. They're not going to show up for the prestige. So
they opened for Metallica on the recent tour. Like,
yeah. They fist bumped Hetfield enough, right? They won't show up just to be in the green room with Metallica. They don't give a shit. Yeah. And no one cares about Dave Grohl. I mean, I love him anymore. I still do like him, but he's not like this, ooh, this huge personality. So yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I kind of get it. I just wish they would phrase it differently.
Yeah, I can agree to that.
Yeah.
A few other minor things. So Pestilence released their new album, Hadeon, on Friday.
Maybe.
But they didn't. Maybe. So to my best understanding, here's what happened. They originally were going to release it on like this time frame, and they announced it with some artwork. But then that big artwork controversy happened where this one artist was like basically plagiarizing a lot of work, and Hadeon was also one of those. And for once, doing the not shitty thing that a death metal band could do, they were like, okay, you know what? Fuck this. This is unacceptable. We're going to delay the album and search for new artwork. I super respect that, right? And then, they found artwork quicker than they expected, and the artwork is, I think, super cool, by the way. And, so I think what happened is somebody forgot to deschedule the album for January. Because it was supposed to come out in March. And the album just came out with little fanfare. And they sent out a press release saying, Pestilence starting tour. And then the press release says, like, the album's going to be released that March at the end of their tour. And then there's a link to pre-order. And then, underneath that, I later added saying, oh, the album's out now digitally for dedicated fans. We trust you, or something like that. Like, it's like this weird ham-fisted thing where they so clearly accidentally released this album. And they're just kind of, instead of trying to, like, you know, Streisand the fact that they're just rolling with it. And, you know, I think that's cool. And I think, by the way, the album is really good. I definitely recommend it. Like, if you like Death or Pestilence, like, this is the best they've sounded in years. Right? Super cool.
Yeah, I can't bring myself to listen to this band because of the person behind it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm not saying you can listen to it. You can do whatever the fuck you want. It just puts me off.
Yeah, he's just kind of a meme, unfortunately.
Yeah, he's also a terrible person. So
yeah. Speaking of Converge and selfies, we mentioned both of those things. this is a silly news story. So you know, we've had occasions where like fans got on stage to do some silly stuff with the band, and then they got like kicked in the head or something like that.
Assaulted.
Yeah, effectively. And surprisingly, Converge didn't do that. Cool of them. So a guy got on stage to take a selfie with the band, and they just stopped playing.
Yep, they just stopped playing. And he also, he kind of like completely botches the face. He doesn't want him to have like a proper selfie.
Yeah.
So he just, his face goes robot. It goes flat.
And they just shame the guy off stage, essentially.
Yeah, he tries to be cool and like stage dive, and obviously like the crowd is like, "Fuck off, man! We don't want your fucking body all over us." And yeah, by the way, if you like drop kick someone coming up stage to take a selfie, you just assaulted someone. So
yeah,
good luck with that. Yeah.
Okay, I think the rest of the stuff we can cover later.
Some of the stuff I want to actually dive into. So
yeah, I agree. All right.
Cool.
Cool people time. Do you have anything to talk about?
Yeah, I finished all the builds in the sky.
Okay, so does it try to sell you a $500 flamethrower?
Fucking Elon Musk. So, okay. The book is not bad. It's good. I enjoyed it. But I wouldn't recommend reading it. It's well written, but the structure is bad. And I especially wouldn't recommend it for you because you hate when endings aren't earned.
Mm-hmm.
So this ending isn't earned, and it's also AI bullshit. So, spoilers. The whole thing is, you know, nature versus science. You know, one of the characters is a witch and the other is a scientist and whatever. And the scientist builds an AI. And that part is actually pretty cool, like how he builds the AI and how it gains consciousness and does it or doesn't it and all sorts of stuff. But then the ending is like this super magical entity, the tree, and the AI merge because nature is a distributed network.
Okay.
Just like the AI, which means that they can be compatible. And that's a super Deus Ex Machina that you never saw coming, and it solves all the problems.
Literally, like Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah, Deus Ex, I don't remember. Arborea. Ha! I do remember how to say it.
There you go.
So, yeah, like individually, like the paragraphs, the sentences are well written, but when you put it all together, it's kind of a mess. And also, at some point, and this is maybe not my major gripe because I just told you my major gripe, but one of the other gripes I have. You know how Ready Player One checks off all the nostalgia boxes? This checks off all the Twitter leftist SJW checkboxes. And I'm saying that as a Twitter leftist SJW. Like, everything is on there. Like, there's a character that's completely relevant and it's shoehorned in just because they use they pronouns. It kind of pushes it in your face. Look, it's a character and they use they pronouns. And you're like, yeah, okay. If you don't want to make a big deal out of it, which you shouldn't, then why are you constantly foisting this on me? And there's, you know, like kind of like the token.
So much for the tolerant left.
It's almost like the token African American in 90s sitcoms. There's the gay couple and it's San Francisco, right? So the elderly gay man and, they pronouns and
I can say, dude, like there's a lot of gay people here. Like they're very openly gay, and that's a very refreshing change from like
everywhere else I've lived. Again, obviously it's fantastic, but when you feel the author kind of winking at you and saying, you see what I did there? You see, I'm progressive, I'm liberal. It's kind of off-putting. So yeah, it's a good book, but it has those two really big flaws that I feel kind of detract from it.
So I started watching something that's really cool, and I think you'll be into this. It's a new TV show called Counterpart.
Okay.
Have you heard of this?
Nope.
It stars J.K. Simmons in the lead role. So J.K. Simmons plays this like paper pusher government employee. He works in some nondescript government agency, right?
Okay.
And one day, like, he goes to work and like he gets pulled into the situation. Turns out that there is a parallel universe, and his parallel universe counterpart is like a super spy.
Huh.
And basically, like, there is some sort of coup or something like that going on. It's kind of not very clear right now, but it's like a very, like, you know, well-made show. And J.K. Simmons is amazing. So it's a very interesting premise of, like, you know, he's this like kind of government employee, you know, document guy, but then like he gets pulled into the situation where, you know, he has the, you know, same face and features as like a super spy, and there's a war between dimensions and something like that. It's like really interesting.
The problem is that it's on Stars.
Yeah.
And I have absolutely no way to legally stream this.
So I don't know if it's available in Israel, but Amazon Prime has channels, and you could buy Stars on Amazon Prime, which is how I watched it.
I mean, I have Prime. I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Okay, the last thing I want to say is that I started Subnautica.
Oh, nice. How do you feel about it?
I played for 2 hours, and it was very fun. So for those of you who are unfamiliar, it's No Man's Sky in the ocean.
No Man's Sea.
No Man... Oh, God. But it's actually good, unlike No Man's Sky. So you play as this guy. I didn't expect it to be sci-fi. You play as this guy. His ship kind of crash lands onto this ocean planet. And you have to survive. So you dive for resources and all sorts of, you know, life forms, fish and plantation, stuff like that. What I liked about it is the balance between scripted events and freeform exploration. So it's not really a spoiler because it's in the first 2 hours of the game. You suddenly get this message that the core of your ship is about to overload, and it kind of freaks you out, and it happens. It's something that will happen in every single game after like an amount of time, and it counts down. And when it does the, you know, the 10, 9, 8, the final countdown, you automatically spin to watch it in this huge explosion. It kind of really nails the feeling and the scope of things. And the fact that it's in the ocean and you can't tell anything on the surface level, and you cannot sometimes get disoriented, is very refreshing. It's a very clever use of the setting.
And it has some really horrific stuff deep down, from what I hear.
Yeah, there's like monsters deep down. I haven't even dared to go where it's dark. I'm super scared. and the loop is really interesting because it's kind of forgiving. So you have hunger and you have thirst. So you constantly have that loop.
Bro, you're just in water. Just drink water.
Yeah, drinking salt water is a great idea.
Yeah.
Don't do that, by the way. That's lethal.
Eat Tide Pods instead.
Oh, Jesus Christ, dude. at least we're explicit on iTunes, so that apparently washes away all your sins. You can do whatever you want.
Just like Tide Pods.
Can I get to the fucking final point I want to make?
Sure.
The game is really good with quickly rewarding you with stuff. Like the repair tool is kind of easy to make, and then you fix your radio and all sorts of stuff unlocks, but it still feels like I have, for lack of a better word, depth to the stuff I need to gather and the resources and the items and stuff like that. So it's a good balance between rewarding, unlike No Man's Sky, where you can spend hours without getting anything that's relevant to your situation. Here, you're constantly tantalized by new gear and relevant stuff. It's a pretty good game.
Yeah.
And it's cheap.
It's like $20, right?
$20, yeah.
Yeah, go play it.
Cool.
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 Thank you for listening.
Cool.
This has been Beavis and Butthead.
Cool.
Bye. Wait. Whoa. Which is which?
I have never watched Beavis and Butthead, so I can't say.
It's fine. It's a shitty show. Daria, sure. Though. Daria, what? Is a great show. Daria?
What's that?
You don't know what Daria is?
No.
It's one of those MTV cartoons from the 90s. It's really good.
I can, I'll do you Ren and Stimpy.
Ren and Stimpy is amazing. I'm starting JoJo this week.
Yes. I'm so excited for you.
Yeah, we'll talk about it next time. I'm gonna watch like one or two episodes over the weekend.
Just one or two. Watch all of it.
Yeah, I don't do binge watching. I don't like that.
Okay.
Cool.
All right. Thank you for listening. Wait, who's Ren, who's Stimpy?
Oh, Jesus Christ. We're both Ren, I guess. I don't know. We're both bitter and shriveled.
You're Stimpy.
I'm Stimpy?
Yeah.
Can I be the horse?
Sure.
What's his name?
I don't fucking know, dude. I remember.
Fine. Simon is the log.
Yeah, that works.
Cool.
All right.
Bye. Bye.